This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The majority of workers here came together and demanded union recognition at DCK6 Amazon.
Amazon workers throughout the country are signing union representation cards and joining the Teamsters Union.
This is a notice to Maersk. You better not be carrying military cargo and coming into the port here. You will be stopped.
Longshore workers hold a rally at the shipping company Maersk in support of the ILA strike and call for a labor boycott of military cargo to Israel.
Unfortunately, it's the same war because it's the same system that's in effect throughout our country and frankly throughout the world, which is oppression, suppression, and then inability because of all of the interests being aligned to try to cover up and not hold police officers accountable.
From California's liberal Bay Area to the Dixie state of North Carolina, police terrorism continues across the U.S.
You know, we need to be cheerleaders. Just being here and saying, hey, I support the Ukrainians, and I support human rights, and I support good.
Is the most recent assassination attempt against former President Trump blowback from the U.S. proxy war against Russia in Ukraine? From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Amazon workers throughout the country are signing union representation cards and joining the Teamsters Union. In San Francisco, 100 workers signed cards for union recognition and demanded immediate recognition. They walked out and rallied in front of Amazon warehouse DCK6.
Maybe small, but I'm a strong Amazon Teamster. Thank you for being here and supporting the workers of DCK6 as we stand up and tell Amazon that we have had enough of unsafe working conditions, of low pay, and we want high quality union jobs here in San Francisco, California.
We're here for you.
Let's go. We are here. My name is Leia, and I work here at DCK6. And yesterday, on October 2nd, the majority of workers here came together and demanded union recognition at DCK6 Amazon. And this city is expensive as hell to live in, and we deserve to not just work here, but to live here too.
I'm Jeanette. I'm here today to support my coworkers and myself. You know, we're really very unhappy with what's going on in there.
You know, what is going on in there?
We just basically have people who are getting paid to do a job they don't do. You know, our safety is being put in danger. We're being worked like pack horses. You know, no one cares. They just come in, they check in, they hit the clock, they get paid for what? Nothing. You know, we just had a new safety person come into our facility, and no one's doing any of the stuff that they're supposed to. I've been there since 2021. I've been here, and I got transferred from another Amazon, you know, so that they could upgrade over here. And since I've been here, I've had no training. They don't do any working wells. You know, and they just basically keep hiring people. People keep leaving, you know, and I'm like, you know, that right there is an answer and a cry out for help right there. And I'm sure administration is seeing all of this information, and they're not doing anything. They just keep hiring people. People keep leaving due to mistreatment, you know, due to all sorts of things. Most of the people that I deal with when it comes to the management, they're more childish than anything. They're not really professionals. You know, they like to play and joke around, and that environment in there is not a place where you do that. You know, they want to, how can I say, haze. You know, they want to haze you and do a lot of things that are very dangerous. You know, and so we're paying for it because we're the ones.
Have there been injuries though?
Oh yeah, I'm as a matter of fact, today at 3-something this afternoon, I have a work-related situation where I got hurt on the job. You know, and since I've been hurt on the job, I haven't had not one manager ask me not one question about Are you doing okay, Ms. Gums? How's your case going? You know, I've talked with your agent, you know, that's in care of whatever it is that's going on with your claim. And we were just, you know, interested in how that's going. It's been 2 years. No one's asked me not a damn thing.
Okay. Where's OSHA?
I haven't seen anyone. I haven't seen not a person. And for a claim to be going on that long, it's going on. It's been a year and something. It's been a year and some change. And so, like I said, I haven't had not one manager. I've just been switched from manager to manager to manager. And I've also been switched to managers I shouldn't even have managing over me. So, you know, like I said, they're definitely not looking at what they need to look at.
The issues here at Amazon containing to health and safety is that they don't hold the standard. It just goes out the window as soon as they need to get things done. And they're rushing us, and we're just honestly, like, we're working twice as hard because they send people home. And so the ones who are left and do stay till the end of the shift, we're working to push double the amount of work that would normally be spread out amongst more coworkers.
Are there injuries here? Are there injuries at this?
There are definitely injuries. A lot of people end up having to go on leave of absences without pay, may I say. And that's one of, like, my personal issues is I've gone to management a couple of times and I told them, I can barely stand. This morning when I got out of bed, I couldn't even put any weight on my feet. Even now, like, I'm trying to keep the weight off of it. And all they told me is, well, go to a doctor, maybe get a note, and we'll try to accommodate you. And, like, that's the best they can do. They can't pay us to take the time off we need to heal. We don't receive the resources we need in order to heal and come back and earn our living.
So workers are breaking down because of the conditions.
Yeah. And we break down, and then we end up quitting, and a new cycle of people come in, and it just continues. It's not going to stop unless we do something about it.
What's the turnover here?
I'm honestly not sure.
But it's a lot of new work.
It's very high. Every time a group of new people come in, we're like, how long do you think they're going to last? It's
take bets on that.
Yeah, exactly. Got a poll going and everything.
And if they tried to intimidate people against the union, if they had separate meetings or something?
Honestly, they can try, but we have an entire team across, like, a nation of people, of Teamsters, that are going to have our back, so we're not really worried about all that.
Those were voices of San Francisco Amazon DCK 6 workers speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
We know you could've stayed home, just cried and cussed. May all your guns go off if it's time to bust. May all their tanks have time to rust. They got the armies turning bullets into gold. They got the hookers turning tricks into coal. And every time the police kicks in the dough, an angel gas breaks, dips in the O. And even if a D-boy flips in my O, it ain't enough to buy anymore. Sleep in the doorway, piss on the floor. Look in the sky, wait for missiles to show. It's finna blow, cause they got the TV, we got the truth. They own the judges and we got the proof. We got hella people, they got helicopters. They got the bombs and we got the
we got the guillotine. We got the guillotine, you better run.
That was The Coup, The Guillotine. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. The International Longshoremen's Association strike ended on Friday, October 4th, when the union reached an agreement with the shipping companies. On that day, supporters of both the ILA strike and Palestine rallied outside the Emeryville, California offices of the Maersk Shipping Company. They called for a labor boycott of military cargo to Israel. retired longshoreman Jack Heyman talked about both struggles.
Workers of the world unite.
We are gathered here to protest in front of Maersk's offices here in Emeryville, right next to Oakland. And we're here to say that what happened to Zim Lines over the last 15 years is that there have been pickets in the port whenever they came into port, and longshoremen honored those picket lines and refused to work the Zim ships because the Israeli government was attacking Palestinian people in the West Bank, even in Jerusalem, and in Gaza especially. And that happened periodically, actually over the 20 years. I remember when the consulate in San Francisco demanded that they come to our meeting of the executive board in Local 10. And they wanted to intimidate us and tell us we can't honor picket lines. We didn't even let them in the building. We kicked them out. We're going to take care of our business, and we continue to honor picket lines around the Zimline ships. So Maersk, we're going to put you on notice. Zimlines does not come into the port of Oakland anymore. And if you keep shipping military cargo to Israel, there'll be pickets on your ships, and you won't be coming into Oakland anymore either. We got to spread this kind of solidarity up and down the coast. It's not just that one port can take an effective action like that. It's got to be coordinated coastwide. In fact, it needs to be coordinated on both coasts, the east and the west coast. We came close to having a nationwide shutdown on the docks in 2020. On the Juneteenth of 2020, George Floyd was murdered by the cops in Minneapolis. And it created angry protests around the world. The majority of our members here in the Port of Oakland are black, and they were very sensitive to that issue of police brutality, of police murdering people of color. And so we called for a mass demonstration on Juneteenth, and we had 20,000 people in the port protesting police terror, and we shut the port down as well. So this is the kind of power that the Longshore Union has. We're in a global economy, and the nexus point of the whole system of logistics is here in the port. Who controls the port has power, and longshore workers do that labor. That's why they have such tremendous power. We appealed to the East Coast Longshore Union, the International Longshoremen's Association. I used to be a member of that union in 1977 when they had their last strike. And the president of the ILW here on the West Coast called the president of the ILA on the East Coast, Teddy Gleason, and he said, "We've got ships coming into port here that have diverted cargo that were supposed to go to the Gulf and the Atlantic for delivery in those ports. And they're being diverted here because of your strike. If you send pickets out here to San Francisco and Oakland and down in Los Angeles and Long Beach, put those pickets up and we will not work those ships. We'll honor your picket lines." And that's the kind of power that won the strike in 1977. One of the pickets that came out here from New York, New Jersey, the port, the big port on the East Coast, was a guy named Harold Daggett. He was just a rank and filer with a picket sign like you people have. And he and a couple others went and put the picket lines up in San Francisco, and some of them went down to LA. Longshoremen on the East Coast refused to cross those picket lines in solidarity with the ILA. So that's what trade union solidarity is about. But while we refused to cross picket lines and work diverted cargo, just last year when our contract was up, the ILA didn't lift a finger to refuse to work diverted cargo in the Gulf ports and the South Atlantic. The ports, the ILA ports on the East Coast were working diverted cargo, or you could say scab cargo. And they didn't stop for 1 minute doing what should have been our work. It should not have been touched. But That was last year, and the ILWU still holds its principles that were established under its 10 guiding principles. We don't cross picket lines, and solidarity doesn't just stop on the waterfront. I want to talk about what's happening on the trade unions on the waterfront for a minute. There is a rightward turn in the ILWU, and shamefully, our union, which has been honoring picket lines of Palestinian people protesting against the Zim lines, unfortunately, the ILA and the ILWU are continuing to work military cargo for this genocidal war. And this is part of the rightward turn. The ILWU has always opposed NATO imperialist wars and the wars that, like the Zionists are conducting, of ethnic cleansing, genocidal wars against the Palestinian people. We have a good, clean record that we're proud of opposing those kind of Zionist attacks. The Consulate of Israel sent a delegation to Local 10. We threw them out of the building. We refused to meet with them. They're sensitive to the power that longshore workers have. And if we can stop Zim lines in this port here, we can stop Maersk as well. If they continue to carry military cargo to Israel, I'm sure that the Palestinian Youth Movement and the Arab Resorts and Organizing Committee are going to mobilize hundreds of people to come out to the port and protest. So this is a notice to Maersk. You better not be carrying military cargo and coming into the port here. You will be stopped. You will be stopped. One last thing about the political situation in this country. While the ILWU, which has been a leftist union over the years, is now continuing to allow military cargo to be shipped to Israel, the leadership, not the rank and file. That's never happened before in the history of our union. The ILA on the East Coast has been a social patriotic, pro-capitalist union that has supported every war that U.S. imperialism has been engaged in. From the Korean War after World War II, with NATO and the U.S. mainly attacking the Korean people, all the way to today, the war in the Ukraine, which is the imperialist powers behind NATO and the U.S., and the Zionist war in Gaza and in Palestine as a whole. Both the presidents of the ILA and the ILWU are of the opinion that the way they get decent contracts is by cozying up to the powers that be, if it's the Democratic Party in the White House or the Republican Party. So Willie Adams, the president of the ILWU, while we were negotiating last year for a longshore contract, went to the White House on numerous occasions and on a ship down in the port of Los Angeles to pose for pictures with Biden by currying favor, he thought, with the CEO of the capitalist class that Biden was going to help in our negotiations. That never happened, okay? And a lot of the members were upset with the contract that was shoved down our throats. On the East Coast, Harold Daggett is the president of the union, the guy who came out to Oakland, San Francisco in 77 with a picket sign. He supports the Gaza war. They've always supported every war by U.S. imperialism. And he, instead of going to Biden, he's been going to Trump. He went down to Mar-a-Lago to meet with Trump. And there's a quote by him saying, well, Trump is going to take care of the automation for us if he gets elected, or he's going to get rid of anti-labor legislation if he's elected. I don't know what the two presidents of these ILA and ILWU unions are smoking, but the way to win a decent contract is not by cozying up to the president and former president. It's the muscle of the rank and file. The ILA rank and file showed their muscle. They voted to go out. Most of the ports voted to shut down the Gulf ports and the East Coast ports. But when they went back to work, that was an order from the president. There was no vote by the rank and file. That's how the ILA works. It's top-down control. And unfortunately, the ILWU is heading in that direction. So what we need politically is not what either of the leaderships of the ILA or ILWU are doing. What we need to do is build caucuses within the trade union movement, class struggle caucuses. They're going to oppose wars like the war in the Ukraine or the Zionist attacks against Palestinians. We need to build class struggle caucuses in the trade unions to oust these phony leaders that pretend like they're representing the rank and file, but they don't. We need to get rid of them. We need to build our own party, a revolutionary workers' party that can take on the capitalist class.
That was Jack Heyman, retired member of ILWU Local 10, recorded by Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer at a rally in Emeryville, California.
You know what my mission is? It feels like I'm speaking to deaf ears. Are you listening? It feels like I'm out of tears. I run off adrenaline. It's been so many years. We had suffered from pillaging. They treat us like animals. Look, we are not citizens. I'm just hoping time heals on with a swing of the pendulum. At minimum, I got war stories. I got more stories. Seen a bomb hit a building. Now it's four stories. What do you ask from us? We dying for massacres. Hit with bullets, because when they pull it, we can't run fast enough. We souls in a sniper scope when they holding the rifles, though. Don't know when this life will go. I just balance the highs and lows. Generational curses. Need a million hearses. All this killing is hurting. I gotta finish my purpose. I may be young, but I got weight on my shoulders. I may be young, but I'ma stand like a soldier. I take my brothers and sisters and hold them. I may be young, but all this pain makes me older. Even though I may be young, I may be young, I may be young, I may be young.
That was MC Abdul, I May Be Young. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. From California's quote-unquote liberal Bay Area to the Dixie state of North Carolina, police terrorism continues in the U.S. Block Report Radio's J.R. Valray interviewed attorney Adante Poynter, co-founder of Lawyers for the People.
Recently, on September 3rd, 22-year-old Amante Hadley died in San Francisco City Jail. And there's a lot of controversy going on around it in San Francisco Bay Area. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the circumstances surrounding this case?
Yeah, sure. This is a 22-year-old sister who was found unresponsive and ultimately pronounced dead on her jail bunk. This is a woman, a young lady, who found herself in jail because it was alleged that she had been out committing some robberies in the community. She's a young person who was diagnosed with a mental health condition, and her attorney and her family were hoping that she would get mental health diversion so she could get the resources and the treatment that she needed, which we believed contributed to her finding herself in this position of being out committing these alleged crimes and just what she had going on in her life. There's many people who have untreated mental health issues that then find themselves on the wrong side of the law. Well, all those requests were denied. My understanding is that the district attorney's office opposed those requests to get her mental health treatment. Mind you, this was her first time ever finding herself in trouble. And because she had been denied mental health diversion, but was being held in custody the entire time fighting her case, she had been in custody close to 2 years and away from her family, 22 years old, never been in trouble before, and wakes up one day, does not wake up one day, and the family is lost as it relates to trying to get any answers. And as many people who've gone through this, either themselves personally with a close loved one, or if you followed the way the government handles these things, when somebody dies in police custody, even though they're forced to rely upon them for their care, the custody, and their medical treatment and everything else, and for their safety and protection, it still doesn't work out that way. And people die, and the family has to fight to get any information about what happened to their loved one. And that's where Amante's family finds themselves in. They're having to do second autopsies. They're having to try to conduct their own investigation. They're having to wait for the government to give them shreds of information just so they can figure out how did their daughter pass away at such a young age. And it's been my experience at the jail. I've had people call me. I know there's police abuse that can happen there. I know that, you know, there's somehow drugs and things like that make their way into the facility, somehow into this facility. There's a lot of questions that the family deserves to know about how their beautiful daughter wound up passing away when she was healthy by all accounts.
Can you give the people a little bit of a history of what has been happening recently in places like San Francisco City Jail, Santa Rita, and jails and prisons in the Bay Area?
You know, unfortunately, there's been too many deaths, too many people whose lives have forever been altered because of lack of adequate medical care while they've been in Bay Area jails, pre-conviction, fighting for their liberty, fighting for their freedom, fighting for justice while facing a criminal case. And so, you know, Santa Rita is a jail that houses inmates or people in the community who have been charged from Alameda County. And it is documented to be one of the deadliest jails in the entire country because people are routinely found there to either have been denied medical care that they needed, which resulted in their death, or they've been abused by guards, you know, or just kind of left for dead if they've been in a medical crisis. So it's one of the most deadliest jails throughout the country, even though the area that it covers is not as big as a New York, L.A., a Houston, a Chicago, or anything like that. A relatively small jail has one of the highest per capita rates. And we see things like this happen in San Francisco City Jail, where people are claiming they've been abused by jailers and or denied services that they need. So the Bay Area finds itself, or even in Santa Clara County Jail here in the bastion or in the seat of Silicon Valley, you know, people have been abused and killed by jail guards or denied medical treatment. It's all documented. It's all things that your listeners can go and find out if they're interested in getting more of the details. And this is in a part of the country that's thought to be liberal, a part of the country that's thought to be progressive, a part of the country that's thought to be compassionate. But one thing is for certain, and many people can appreciate this if they have a loved one who's ever been in custody, it's as if no one cares about the person who's in custody, whether they've been convicted or not, whether they've been charged with a serious crime or not. You could be in there simply for being poor and not being able to afford bail and wind up having your life taken from you or your life significantly altered. And there's just not enough people within our society who are demanding and are in position to have the leverage to force our government to do right by our loved ones who find themselves on the other side of that jail wall.
You were recently doing some legal work in North Carolina. Can you tell us what's really going on out there in relationship to the black community versus the police? Do they have the same war at hand, or do you see something different going on?
Unfortunately, it's the same war because it's the same system that's in effect throughout our country and frankly throughout the world, which is oppression, suppression, and then an ability because of all of the interests being aligned to try to cover up and not hold police officers accountable. So you're right. I was out in North Carolina dealing with the Benbow case, which is out by the beach areas in North Carolina. And the police supposedly had this tip that his young brother was some type of major supplier of drugs, when in actuality, he was nothing more, if it could even be claimed, if you believe that he was involved, he was nothing more than a bit player, a role player, nothing, no type of El Chapo or anything like that. And nevertheless, you had an undercover surveillance team with 6-7 police officers come out, surveil, trail him. And interestingly enough, they thought he was a drug dealer, and they thought that they saw him engaged in a drug deal. They follow him, arrest his people that he was with, wind up doing a pit maneuver, which is when the police car hits the back of the car that they're pursuing and it causes the car to spin out. And in this case, based upon our information, the police officers did it in a place and they did it improperly and it caused not only the car to spin out, but to flip and flip into an oncoming car filled with a family. Our client's son was ejected from that car, the one that they were pursuing, and died there on the pavement. And it broke the ribs and frightened the heck out of the family that they hit. And the police claim that our guy caused the accident, when there's witnesses who say the police caused the accident. Now, going back to what I said, the police were surveilling this young man prior to them doing the pit maneuver, which caused him to be ejected from his car. And when they say that they claim he did a drug deal, interestingly enough, the person they claimed that he did the drug deal with, his brother, was a white guy. And they didn't never identify the white guy, never stop the white guy, didn't have a police try to pull him over, didn't even get his license plate, didn't have a description of him. So the only person that they were interested in arresting, detaining, and ultimately killing was the black person that was involved. And they let the white person who was supposedly involved in the drug deal go free. Hmm. And I refuse to stand and sit on the sideline when I hear things like that. There must be accountability. And in that part of the country, police get away with so much because the laws are written in such a way, and with the qualified immunity and the judges who are willing to give that to the cops to let them walk away scot-free. So it's an uphill battle, but it's one that I'm willing to take because the principle is so important.
What is police qualified immunity? Because Trump has been talking about he wants to extend immunity to all police officers. What does that mean legally?
Qualified immunity is a legal fiction, something that was made up by judges. It's not in the Constitution anywhere. It's something that a judge made up that essentially says, in the course of a police officer doing, quote unquote, their job, if they make a mistake, if they accidentally do something, they wouldn't know that what they did was wrong because there hasn't been a court precedent that says that this particular thing is wrong for you to do and it violates the law, then the cops get a pass. And that's the way it started. The way it's playing out in court nowadays and in cases nowadays is that you can have a cop, and this is a real case, cops go search somebody's house, search somebody's car, and they come up with $100,000 and they steal the money, keep the money, don't report the money, literally steal the money from someone, and the court used qualified immunity to say, well, how would the cops know that that was wrong to do? Unless there was another court case somewhere else in the country that says that that's wrong. And surprisingly enough, there was no court case that the court could find to say that what the cops did was wrong. So those cops got to essentially get out of that scot-free without being held accountable. In certain parts of the country, they use qualified immunity to excuse bad conduct away, to excuse police abuse away, to say that, hey, if police are chasing somebody, and this person's wanted for running a traffic light or driving a car that doesn't have registration, police can essentially use deadly force on them. And hey, you know, we could hit the car, and if the person winds up dying, you know, don't blame us because, hey, how will we know that we couldn't do that? Because there's not a case somewhere that says that that's against the law or that's not right. So qualified immunity is something that essentially we give officers a free pass to do whatever they want. And you couldn't hold them accountable. And that's what Trump is advocating for. That's scary. That is not something that we should have going on in this country. Everyone must be held accountable to the law. You can't have a two-tier justice system where law enforcement gets a VIP pass and the average person gets taken, you know, to the cleaners and held accountable.
You were a defense attorney while Kamala Harris was working in California as well as in the Bay Area. What do you think about the policies of Kamala Harris? I know that she was controversial as a district attorney. What are your opinions on Kamala Harris and police terrorism?
Look, police terrorism is as American as apple pie. You know, police started out as slave catchers and then it evolved into, quote unquote, a more professional, you know, institution of policing that we see today. But the root is from slave catching. And just as we know, the racists, the KKK, the new name is the Proud Boys, or, you know, the lineage of racism and racists have not disappeared. They traded in their hoods and robes for different uniforms. So we have police terrorism here in the Bay Area. And while Kamala Harris was the district attorney, police terrorism was still going on at the same rate it always has. So I don't consider her to be someone that, you know, stopped police terrorism on her watch. It still continued. And when the community cried out for help, it still continued. And it still continues to this day, despite her being a local DA, for being the statewide attorney general, and now the vice president. You know, politics requires more than one person in order to make change. You have to get agreement. You have to be a person that can rally people around thoughts and ideas in order to get bills passed. All the blame doesn't fall at her feet. She decided to take on a job as a prosecutor. That's not a job I want as a criminal prosecutor. I don't think the system needs my help in that way. But that's the job that she elected to take on and was elected to do the duty on behalf of all the people in the community. There are many people out here who are torn. You know, they have a lot of respect for her for whatever reason, and they want to see her do well, and they would love to see her become the president. But there's also people here in the community who feel that she could have done better to look out for the community, who have always suffered the onslaught of policing and a criminal injustice complex. So, you know, her history is a mixed bag. You know, I always have said, if she gets to the White House, then we as the Black community, we as the Black and Brown community, have to make demands upon her, have to make demands upon the Democratic Party to do right by us. It's not enough to have symbolic leadership. Right. You need substantive leadership in order to make change.
That was just the voice of Adante Poynter, who is an attorney as well as co-founder of Lawyers for the People, right here on the Block Report with the People's Minister of Information, J.R. Valray. If people would like to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Reach out to me. Social media is just my name, Adante Poynter, A-D-A-N-T-E Poynter. Looking for my law firm, lawyers.ftp for the people. That's how you can find me. Not hard to find. I love to talk to people and love to help our community work through their issues.
Well, thank you, bro, for being once again on the Block Report.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure and an honor, and keep doing what you do. Our community needs this information, Minister.
Right on, bro. Appreciate you. We need you too. Salute.
And the rest will fall behind. Tell me who's got control of your mind, your worldview. Is it the news or the movie you taking your girl to? Know what I'm saying? Cause Uncle Sam got a plan. If you examine what they telling us, then you will understand what they planting in the seeds of the next generation. Feeding our children miseducation. No one knows if there's UFOs or any life on Mars, or what they doing when they up in the stars. Because I don't believe a word of what the president said. He filling our head with lies, got us hypnotized when he be speaking in cold words about crime and poverty, drugs, welfare, prisons, guns, and robbery. It really means us. There's no excuse for the slander, but what's good for the goose is still good for the gander, see?
I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. They killed Huey because they knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is propaganda.
That was Dead Prez, Propaganda. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Next, Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke explores the political beliefs of would-be Trump assassin Ryan Ruth and the Ukraine proxy war Petri dish.
Ryan Wesley Ruth was arraigned Monday, September 30th, in a Palm Beach County federal courthouse. Ruth pled not guilty to charges of attempting to assassinate former President Trump, as well as assaulting a federal officer and illegally possessing a firearm with the intent of its violent use. Controversially, DOJ prosecutors had earlier published on the court docket a handwritten letter by Ruth apologizing for his failure to kill Trump, but offering a $150,000 bounty to anyone who takes up and completes this mission. Next, we'll hear from Glenn Greenwald speaking on his Systems Update webcast about the background of this would-be assassin and observations about the current political climate, including fallout from the ongoing proxy war in Ukraine.
Here from the New York Times, Trump safe after what FBI describes as an assassination attempt. Quote, the Federal Bureau of Investigation said it was investigating what appeared to be a second assassination attempt on former President Donald J. Trump. Former President Trump was playing golf on Sunday afternoon in Florida when a Secret Service agent spotted a man with a rifle standing by a chain link fence on the perimeter of the course, law enforcement officials said. The suspected gunman was identified as Ryan Wesley Ralph, 58, of Hawaii, according to a law enforcement official. Mr. Ralph was interviewed by the New York Times in 2023, last year, for an article about Americans volunteering to aid the war effort in Ukraine. Mr. Ralph, who had no military experience, said he had traveled to the country after Russia's invasion in 2022 to recruit Afghan soldiers to fight there. He told the Times he once visited Washington to meet with politicians to strengthen support for Ukraine. Quote, I'm just a U.S. citizen that's helping out, he told the Times. There's all kinds of evidence that he was, in fact, in Ukraine, including all sorts of photographs that he posted to social media, all kinds of people in Ukraine who knew him. And there's no doubt he went to Ukraine with the explicit attempt of doing everything possible to aid the Ukrainian cause. And he made very clear that his goal was the destruction of all of Russia, the murder of Vladimir Putin, regime change, and basically blowing Russia to little bits and pieces, something he was insisting was our moral obligation to do. Again, aligning himself very closely with not only the Democratic Party, you remember every single member of the Democratic Party has that same view of Ukraine. Every single one of them voted to fuel and fund the war with tens of billions of dollars, in fact, hundreds of billions, who believe it's our moral obligation to do everything possible to fight that war, help that Ukraine fight that war and win, no matter what risks we incur. But he also, as I said, went beyond that and began having serious anti-Trump animus, despite having said he voted for Trump in 2016, something he claimed he came to regret very deeply, and by 2022 or 23, he viewed Trump as the gravest threat, which was very clearly at least a factor, a major factor, in why he tried to kill him. Now, the first shooter is something we still know very little about. Despite being 20 years old, he had almost no online presence, and yet he got very close to Trump, had Trump in his sights, actually hit Trump with one of his bullets, killed one of the persons attending Trump's rally in Pennsylvania, severely wounded another. And we were told, oh, look, there's no political motive to it. This is just an apolitical loner. And now 2 months later, someone with a clear political agenda tried to murder Donald Trump. Despite how clear this is, the corporate wing of the media, the part that is devoted to the Democratic Party, is trying to run interference to say, oh, it's impossible to decipher this person's political views, despite everything I just got saying. He's just kind of freak, some kind of crazy person who seems to have been all over the map. No, just another second mentally ill person bereft of any real politics. Here from Time Magazine, also today, quote, the suspect arrested in relation to the shooting at Trump's golf course in Florida on Sunday has been identified as Ryan Ruth, a 58-year-old with unclear political ideology. I just want to highlight this part here because I think I've already expressed enough facts that make that remarkably deceitful to say that he has an unclear political ideology. I think they're saying that because he voted for Donald Trump in 2016, but then immediately or shortly thereafter said how much he was disappointed in Trump and regrets having done that. He then at some point supported Tulsi Gabbard, saying she should run on a ticket with Vivek Ramaswamy to defeat Trump. Remember, Tulsi Gabbard was at the time, very recently, a member of the Democratic Party. She endorsed Bernie Sanders in 2016. She ran for president as a Democrat in 2020. And then when she pulled out of the race, she endorsed Joe Biden over Donald Trump. But if you look at his tweets and everything else he said, including a video he recorded while in Ukraine, it's beyond clear. There's nothing unclear about his political ideology. He's basically a never Trump neocon. He wants to have the U.S. go to war to protect Taiwan against China. He's fanatically supportive of the Democratic policy, the Biden-Harris policy of fueling the war in Ukraine, which a lot of Republicans, almost the entire establishment wing of the Republican Party, also supports. And he It says here he has a history of praising Iran and supporting Ukraine. Iran has been supplying weapons to Russia. He wasn't praising Iran. He was asking Iran to help kill Vladimir Putin. That's what he was urging Iran to do. Here is a video that was first published in Newsweek Romania in June of 2022, so just 3 or 4 months after Russia massively invaded Ukraine, where he is in Ukraine being interviewed by a Ukrainian who speaks English with a clear Ukrainian accent about why he's in Ukraine and what he's hoping to accomplish.
You know, we need to be cheerleaders. Just being here and saying, hey, I support the Ukrainians and I support human rights and I support good and generosity and caring and kindness, yeah, and altruism. And it's just, you know, we need to show the world that we care. And it's essential. You know, if you don't do any work at all, just being here and supporting and showing them that we care for our fellow human beings is the most important thing we can do.
Now, just to be clear, that video was 10 minutes long. It went very much in that vein. And I personally look at that and I don't see an insane person. I see somebody who's very genuine, who's very clear-headed about how he sees the war in Ukraine and how he sees Russia. He repeatedly says he sees it as good versus evil. He has been convinced by the prevailing Western media narrative, convinced by the American media narrative, that this is a fight of good versus evil, that there's no worse monster, maybe in history, but certainly now, than Vladimir Putin, and that people all over the West should be going there and risking their lives and fighting and willing to die, as he said he was, for Ukraine. This is not somebody who's babbling incoherently, who has some kind of set of all sorts of conflicting views out of mental illness. I could show you all 10 minutes, and it was just like that, very coherent, very clear about what he thinks. It fits right in. He could go on any MSNBC show or write for any Never Trump neocon site like The Bulwark, founded by Bill Kristol, or The Dispatch, founded by Jonah Goldberg. Any of those sites, he would fit right in. Topic that animates him the most is the war in Ukraine, and then eventually became Trump's threat to democracy. Here, I think, is one of the most interesting things is last year, the New York Times considered him sufficiently important in the attempt to create an international volunteer force led by Americans to try and gather people from around the world, encourage them, as Vladimir Zelensky urged people to do at the start of the war, Westerners who support the Ukrainian cause to come to Ukraine and fight. He took that call very seriously. He himself went. And here's the New York Times recounting their experience with the suspected shooter. The title is, "Suspected Gunman Said He Was Willing to Fight and Die in Ukraine." Text, in a telephone interview with the New York Times in 2023, when Mr. Routh was in Washington, he spoke with the self-assuredness of a seasoned diplomat who thought his plans to support Ukraine's war effort were sure to succeed. He appeared to have little patience for anyone who got in his way. When an American foreign fighter seemed to talk down to him in a Facebook message he shared with the New York Times, Mr. Routh said, quote, "He needs to be shot." In the interview, Mr. Rouse said he was in Washington to meet with the U.S. Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe, known as the Helsinki Commission, quote, for 2 hours to help push for more support for Ukraine. That commission is led by members of Congress and staffed by congressional aide, and it is influential on matters of democracy and security and has been very vocal in supporting Ukraine. And I think that this has always been one of the understated reasons to be so concerned about the war in Ukraine. Historically, when the United States or any Western country floods some war zone with highly sophisticated weaponry, and now we're talking about tanks and fighter jets and long-range ballistic missiles, those always end up somewhere that we then have to go and fight. And beyond where those weapons go, and you're talking about pouring immense amounts of weaponry into the most corrupt country in Europe by far, in the middle of a war zone where nothing is being tracked, where there's hundreds of billions of dollars flowing of American and European money. And beyond the question of where these weapons are going to go, it's attracting a lot of fanatics, a lot of highly violent people. Who else would go to Ukraine from the West in order to volunteer to fight on the front lines with Ukraine against the Russian army? Just people who are looking for violence, who are looking for some kind of escape from their lives. Maybe people who get convinced that that's the moral thing to do. But clearly this person is one of them. And it's completely unsurprising if you've participated at all in the Ukraine-Russia debate or the debate over U.S. policy toward Ukraine. These fanatical supporters of the Ukraine war are among the most extremist people you will ever meet. They're unstable. They're violent. They're just connected into the crudest, most vulgar discourse of war. And when you spend years, and this is also an understated impact of a country going to war, I used to talk about this a lot during the war on terror, when you just spend years demonizing an enemy as Hitler, the Nazis, the pure embodiment of evil, you talk about the need to destroy them and blow them up and bomb them to smithereens and kill that country and destroy their country and the glories of war, and you just keep connecting to that mentality, you're going to come back from a war zone oriented toward violence and extremism. Not everyone, of course. I mean, members of the U.S. military are professionally trained not to be that way, and yet a lot of them come back with all kinds of problems with their mental health as well. It's one of the tragedies of sending people to unnecessary wars, not just that they're killed or physically wounded, but their mental health is affected as well. The other, I think, darkly hilarious aspect of this attempt to say, oh, we just have no idea what his ideology is. It's so confusing. Just indiscernible. He's just crazy. Is this tweet from April 2022 of this year, where he tweeted directly at POTUS, the president of the United States, who at the time was Joe Biden. And this is what he wrote to Joe Biden, quote, your campaign should be called something like KADAF, Keep America Democratic and Free. It's an acronym that rolls off the tongue. We are the cutoff movement, Keep America Democratic and Free. Trump's slogan, however, should be MASA, M-A-S-A, Make Americans Slave Again, Master. And then he said this, which every single liberal, every single Democrat on television with a column that I know has said or written this at some point in the last 8 years. Quote, democracy, all caps, is on the ballot and we cannot lose. We cannot afford to fail. The world is counting on us to show the way. So what is unclear about this? You tell me. He's begging Joe Biden to win the 2024 election on the ground that Trump wants to make Americans slaves, whereas Joe Biden and the Democrats want to keep America democratic and free. And he's saying democracy is on the ballot, meaning the only way we can save American democracy is if we vote for Joe Biden or the Democrats and against Donald Trump. The whole world, he said, is counting on us to show the way. Does that sound like an unclear or difficult to decipher political perspective? In 2023, he wrote a manifesto of sorts that he entitled Unwinnable War by Ryan Routh. And the subheadline was The Fatal Flaw of Democracy, World Abandonment, and the Global Citizen. Taiwan, Afghanistan, North Korea, World War III, and the End of Humanity. This is only 4 months ago. Quote, why has Putin not been assassinated? The swirling question in every chat around the world as to why Putin has not yet been killed. I have asked many occasions of countless people in Ukraine to cross over into Russia and smuggle ourselves to Moscow to handle the job, but all help loses its courage and will to make something happen. The entire world runs and hides in fear of Putin just because he has nuclear weapons. Why has the world been afraid of Russia for the last 100 years or 300 or 1,000 years when we have the power to end it? We must strike first. We must give Ukraine back all of their nuclear warheads that we took away with the only stipulation that they all be used. So not only are we supposed to give Ukraine a whole pile of nuclear weapons, the condition for giving them to that is they must use them all against Russia. Quote, we must instigate this war and push the issue to the end.
That was independent journalist Glenn Greenwald on his show, Systems Update. For Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, I'm Thomas O'Rourke.
And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, J.R. Valray, Thomas O'Rourke, and myself, Paulina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.